Well, good morning. And as Wes said, the aim is this morning is to apply Romans. And we're not so much going to apply individual bits as we've been doing as we've gone along, but to stand back and apply some of the big things we've seen through the letter. That reflects the fact that God has given us this letter for one big purpose. He's given us this letter that we want to have an impact in our lives, and we want to have that God to have that impact through it. So we're going to stand back a bit and review. Then we'll have lots of time in groups to discuss and some time to pray as well in response. Let me just say, remember those we've come to application. That application is not about leaving with a thick list of things to go and do, primarily, but to change how we think and what we believe, because living differently will come from that. So that's what we're doing this morning. But let's start just by reflecting on our time in Romans. You'll see at the top of the handout, there's a couple of questions. Maybe just pick one or two of those questions and then turn to pray. And maybe do that in twos and threes so you have lots of time to talk together. And you've got 5 minutes just to do that. So pick one or two questions in twos and threes and then pray quickly in response to what you discuss. Okay, let me draw us back together there. Okay, we're going to take the rest of our time in two halves. So we'll spend, firstly, just thinking big picture about what Paul is doing as he writes Romans, what he wants to achieve, why he's doing it that way. And then second, and we'll spend some time discussing and praying in response to that. And then secondly, we'll work through the letter and think about how he actually does that as he goes through. But first of all, you'll see summarised there, big purpose. So what is Paul doing as he writes Romans? Well, I've summarised it as he's persuading Christians to line up behind God's global gospel mission. So God is doing something in the world. God has a global mission. Paul is throwing his life behind it. And as he writes this Roman church, remember that they're in a good shape. There's no massive issues to sort out. And they're also in a good place geographically for the next stage of Paul's ministry across to the Western Mediterranean. And so he writes to persuade them to increasingly line up with what God is doing in the world. But to see what God is doing, we need to start where Paul starts, with the message of the gospel. So first question there, what is the gospel message? We'll open Romans, if you're not there already, to chapter 1. We'll be looking at Romans a bit, so get a Bible open. Romans chapter 1, verse 1. Remember, Paul said he was set apart for the gospel of God. Verse 3, which he said was summarized as concerning His Son. So the gospel is about Jesus. But what is it about Jesus? Well, verse 4, the gospel is that Jesus has been declared to be the Son of God in power. Remember, that's not primarily about his divinity only, but it's about his position. Remember, we looked how in the Old Testament, in Psalm 2, the Son of God is the one that God has appointed as the ruler of all nations, the king who will reign over everyone. Verse 4, back in Romans, that's been seen in his resurrection from the dead, which has shown that he is Jesus Christ, our Lord. Again, remember Christ, Messiah, that title. Again, he's the King, he's the Lord, he's the ruler and judge of all. That's why he mentions David in verse 3, remember? He was the great king, but Jesus is David's promised descendant who will reign on his throne forever. So there's the message that God has given to Paul and to us. That Jesus is God's global, eternal King. And therefore, verse 5, if you look down, because that is Paul's message, the big goal, the big task before us is to bring about the obedience of faith for the sake of his name among all the nations. Or in other words, because Jesus is God's global King forever, all nations, all people must submit to him. And so if that's the message that Paul and we have been given, which means that all people everywhere must submit to Jesus. What is Paul doing about it? Well, remember, we've had these three steps we've come back to again and again through the year. What is Paul doing? First of all, Paul has been declaring the gospel to them. That's what he spent the letter doing. To bring about conviction in the gospel. Or in other words, so people believe it more and more deeply, have more and more certainty in it, so that people live in obedience to him more and more. So they line up their lives behind what Jesus is doing in the world. And we've seen that Paul is doing the same thing with both Christians and with unbelievers. It works slightly differently depending on which it is, but it's the same basic thing that Paul is doing. So look back to chapter 1. Paul first mentions the middle of those three steps. So look at verse 11. He wants to come to them to give them some spiritual gift to strengthen them. Or verse 12, he describes it as encouraging them. So he wants them to deepen their conviction and their confidence in the gospel message. The reason he wants to do that is that, so the third step, verse 13, he reaps some harvest among them. He wants to see them increasingly living for Jesus. And so what does he want to do? If that's what he wants to get to when he comes to them, well, what will he do in the meantime as he writes to them? Well, verse 15, he says, I'm eager to preach the gospel to you who are in Rome. We see that process there. Or flick to the very end of the letter, where you see Paul talking about a very similar thing. Flick on to chapter 15, right at the end. We'll be flicking around a bit, so you may find it easier to have two Bibles open. But chapter 15 and verse 14. Again, remember, they're a good church in a good shape. They're filled with all knowledge. They're able to instruct one another. But yet, verse 15, he's still taking a lot of time to remind them boldly of what they know. So that, verse 16, they become increasingly part of this acceptable offering of the Gentiles, living in obedience to Jesus. But with those who aren't Christians, Paul does the same basic thing. So look down to verse 20. Paul's ambition is to preach the gospel. So that verse 21, those who haven't been told will see. Those who've never heard will understand. So again, look back at that process. Paul wants to declare the gospel again to unbelievers so that they have conviction in the gospel. So they come to believe it for the first time. And so they submit their life to Jesus' lordship, and they become part of this acceptable offering of the Gentiles. But the next question there, why does Paul do it that way? Why does Paul do it this way? Because we could think of all sorts of ways that Paul could try and persuade people to become Christians. And we see all sorts of ways around us that people try and do that. So we could just do really nice things to people and they would like us and think, I'll become a Christian. We could try and transform the society we live in so people become Christians. We could try and do fun things to entertain people and they might come back more. We could build impressive buildings, as lots of people have done, to attract people. Why has Paul got this very narrow focus on the gospel message? Well, turn back to chapter 1 of Romans. I said we'd be flicking around. Romans chapter 1. And verse 16. So verse 15, he told us he wants to preach the gospel to them. Why has he got this particular focus? Well, verse 16, because the gospel message is God's power to save anyone who believes. The words that he writes to the Romans, the message that he speaks, are God's power to save. We could say some words to someone, even in a very broken kind of way, and by the work of God's Spirit, those words are God's power to save anyone by faith. And that's remarkable, isn't it? It doesn't look impressive, but that is what makes the gospel the one thing to put our energy into. But it's not just in evangelism in with those who aren't Christians. Because again, Paul wants to strengthen this church. We could think of all sorts of things we could do to help Christians. We could get kind of gurus in to give lifestyle advice. We could set up groups to learn techniques together. We could make church a really impressive show as it gives people a big buzz. We could get eloquent, entertaining speakers in who've got impressive CVs. Again, why has Paul got this narrow focus on the gospel message? Well, because, turn to chapter 16. Chapter 16, very end of the whole letter. Look at how Paul finishes. Chapter 16, verse 25. Paul says, now to him who is able to strengthen you according to my gospel and the preaching of Jesus Christ. So Paul knows that as he preaches Jesus, God does his work of strengthening people according to this message. It's worth saying in passing, that's why the city ministry is as it is. Why we spend Wednesday mornings studying God's word. Why Tuesdays and Thursdays are devoted to teaching the scriptures, because it is the gospel message, that is God's power to strengthen us as Christian and to save those who aren't Christians. So that's what Paul's doing and why he's doing it. But last question there, what would it look like to line up behind this mission? If that's what Paul wants this church to do, what would it look like? Just glance back on the page, chapter 15, and remember the different ways in which Paul encouraged this church to line up behind what God's doing in the world. So verse 24 of chapter 15, I remember Paul wanted help on his way to Spain, so probably taking a collection or buying a boat or something for him. Verse 30, he wants them to strive in their prayers for him. Verse 32, he wants them to refresh him with their company, to encourage him. I guess all those things will be happening on the Wednesday morning. Chapter 16, we have this list, don't we, of fellow gospel workers. But think about what that means. I guess it's the phrase we kind of trips off the tongue. But remember that the gospel is the announcement, it's the news that Jesus is Lord, that he is King. And so a fellow gospel worker is a fellow announcement worker. And so I guess they're doing what they can to play their part in speaking this message. For example, we know verse 3, chapter 16, Prisca and Aquila, they were doing that in Acts, for example. But also to line up behind this message means verse 17 of chapter 16, to watch out. I don't know if you think of that as being a way of lining up behind what God's doing in the world. Being behind God's global gospel mission means being concerned that the message that is being spread is the true message, the message that strengthens and saves, not another message that divides. So watching out, another key part of gospel partnership in this work. So that's what Paul's doing. Let's now turn back in twos and threes around tables. You'll see a few more questions in the box. Again, maybe just pick one or two. Talk about them together, apply them further, and then turn to pray that we would have that increasingly. Let's do this just in smaller groups around tables so we get more time, chance to talk and to pray. And I'll call us up again in a few minutes. Okay, let me draw us back together there. I'm aware there's lots more we could talk about and more questions you probably have time for. And part of the idea behind that is that you might want to keep hold of these questions, and when you meet up over the summer, whether that's just with two or three people from the group or as a whole group, why not keep thinking about Romans, keep applying it to each other, keep reminding each other of what we've seen. Hopefully this is just the beginning of a conversation which will continue on into the summer over the break. But let's keep moving. So bottom of the first page, point two there. If that is Paul's big aim, to persuade people to line up behind God's global gospel mission, how does Romans actually persuade us to do that? So we're going to work through the letter very quickly just to remind us roughly of what's there, and then we'll have some more time to talk it over. So let's go back to Romans chapter 1 though. But when tragedy occurs, as sadly has done in recent weeks, people try and explain things by reference to all sorts of upbringing or ideology or backgrounds. But we know as Christians, we've seen in Romans, first point there, that there is actually an underlying, unfixable problem behind it all. And this is the first thing Paul does to persuade us to line up behind the gospel. Remember chapter 1, verse 18? The real problem underneath everything else is God's wrath at truth suppression. God has given humanity over to debased minds that produce evil behavior. I remember how we saw that again and again in chapter 1, verse 24 over the page. Therefore, God gave them up. Or verse 26, for this reason, God gave them up to dishonorable passions. Or verse 28, and since they did not see fit to acknowledge God, God gave them up to a debased mind. And that is a universal problem. We think often that most decent people or religious people will be okay. People look well off, respectable. The city's all about looking as good as you can. But Paul showed us chapters 2 and 3, there's no exceptions to this. Being in kind of relatively better off doesn't help. Being having the best religious credentials doesn't help. Everybody is in the same boat without the gospel. Or maybe we could think, well, maybe that's just a bit extreme, a bit unfair. Maybe in the end people will be okay. God will sort of let people off. But remember, we saw that God will be totally right and just. He will judge culpable truth suppressors impartially. God is not biased by the things that we see on the outside. He'll judge fairly. But the gospel we saw is the unbelievable, unearned, upright, universal solution. First of all, it's upright in the sense that God does it the right way. There's no compromise and there's no fudge. There's nothing to be embarrassed about. So turn to the end of chapter 3, verse 21 to 26, where Paul unpacks this for us. So verse 25, remember. End of verse 25. This was to show God's righteousness. Or verse 26, it was to show his righteousness at the present time, that he might be just and the justifier of the one who has faith in Jesus. There's nothing to be embarrassed about in terms of the way God saves people. And it's universal as well, this solution. Remember 23 and 24. There is no distinction. All have fallen short and are justified by his grace. It's for everyone. It's universal because it is unearned, because it is a gift. Verse 24. And chapter 4 then showed that. It really is for anybody. And so it is unbelievable, this solution. It's amazing. But then secondly, chapters 5 to 8, Paul takes us to see how much God has achieved through this gospel message and how much he will achieve. So over the page there, as I've summarised, where we were guilty enemies, enslaved to sin, facing death and wrath. But the gospel means that we are justified. Remember 5 verse 1, we've been justified by faith. If you had a status against your name somewhere, that has gone from guilty to perfect. Unbelievable. And therefore, while we were enemies, we are now at peace. So we can't see it, but every unbeliever around us is at war with God. There is hostility. But we, because of the gospel, are now at peace. And remember, we have been transformed. So God had handed over humanity, us included, to sinful desires. And it's not saying we're all as bad as we could be, but everything is still acting in sin. But the gospel has transformed us. Remember how we've been given a new master, a new slavery. We've been given new hearts, new desires. We were facing wrath like the rest of mankind. But now, remember, we are heirs, chapter 8. We're heirs with the Lord Jesus. We sitting here this morning may not look at anything special, but we are going to inherit the universe. And that is pretty staggering. But what the gospel has done is only the beginning. Paul then shows us what the gospel will do. And we'll be immortal, perfected, new creation dwellers. So again, we don't look or feel any different. Lots of the time we still suffer, we get ill, we die. We experience the effects of sin. But one day we will be given glorious new bodies. Remember chapter 8, verse 11. We will have life. Just as Jesus has been raised. We'll be given new immortal bodies. We've seen as well that we're currently experiencing the battle with sin. Living as a Christian can feel harder than it did before often. Because this change has begun. But one day we'll be fully like Jesus. Remember chapter 8 verse 29. We'll be conformed to his image. And we'll be perfected. We'll be immortal. And we'll dwell in this new world. So remember how chapter 8 talked about as us experiencing this frustration, but the whole of creation being enslaved to bondage, chapter 8, verse 20 and 21. But one day God is going to set the world free from that. He's going to make it new, and we will dwell there forever. All because of this gospel message. And then thirdly there, this is all guaranteed. So the big climax of chapter 8, what we have now, what we'll have in future, it's not just kind of one possible outcome that God is really hoping he can pull off. But it is guaranteed. And the big reason is because, as chapter 8 verse 31 says, if God is for us, who can be against us? If God is for us in a fixed, unchangeable, unquestionable way, we know that all of this will be ours because of this gospel message. I remember the argument in chapter 5, if God treated us like this when we were enemies, now that we're friends, we can be sure that we're sorted. I remember the argument in chapter 8, that God has not just done half and got half to do, but he's done the big thing. He's given Jesus for us. He's obviously not going to put that to waste. He's going to finish the job. And remember also chapter 8 verse 34, who is to condemn? I remember chapter 1, Jesus is king, he's Lord, he's the only opinion that matters. He's the only relationship we ultimately need to worry about. But verse 33, 34, he is the one who died for us. More than that, he is the one who is interceding for us. The gospel makes us so safe and secure. It is guaranteed for us. And then we move into chapters 9 to 11, where I think there's two big things to remind us of. In the gospel, first of all, God is being utterly consistent and faithful to who he is. So remember how we thought about, does this mean that God has changed his mind? Or has God changed his plan? And think back to the Roman situation. For us, Christianity is well established. It's been around a long time. For them, it was could have felt like a new thing, a novel thing. But Paul shows us that his message is not a new one. It's the same thing that God has been saying across history. So we're confident in that message, and we're confident in the God who is behind this message. And we saw that God is consistent in his choosing. He's not changed who he is or how he works. He never intended to save all the physical descendants of Israel. So don't be knocked if you see many Jewish people rejecting Jesus today. In fact, that's what God said would always happen. Remember how we thought about how lots of people say God can't do that. He's not allowed to choose. And Paul said, no, that is who God is. He's been consistent with who he revealed himself to be. He can do that. He has mercy on those who he will have mercy on. There's nothing to be embarrassed or ashamed about. God is being utterly consistent and faithful to who he is. But then secondly, point there, in the gospel, God is being unbelievably wise and merciful to fulfill his plan as he saves people from all nations. So what looked like a possible weakness as lots of Jewish people were rejecting the gospel in Paul's day is actually the means by which God has taken this message from the Jews to the Gentiles also, so that people from all nations are saved, just as he promised. And that as that happens, remember, the Jews would see the Gentiles enjoying all that they should have received, and they too will be brought in. And so God has mercy on all. As Paul says in 11 verse 33, oh, the depth of the riches and wisdom and knowledge of God. The gospel shows God's consistency and faithfulness and his wisdom and his mercy. And then finally, chapters 12 to 15. The gospel really does produce an utterly transformed new humanity to reverse what we saw back in chapter 1. I remember how the problem wasn't just God's future judgments or our present status, but also the unrighteous living that God had handed people over to. Remember the lists, the impurity, dishonouring bodies, murder, envy, strife, gossip. What does the gospel do about all those ways of living? Well, the final section shows that the gospel really does transform people. It really does produce a new humanity. I don't know if you think about it like this, but what we have here on Wednesday mornings is an imperfect glimpse of the new creation as we live profoundly different lives shaped by the gospel message. Not yet perfectly, but in part. We see what will one day be the way of living in the world to come. And the world loves the idea of these things, but just cannot produce it. And I've listed some of those down there. Humbly serving each others. Remember this body image, the order, the goodness that the gospel produces, the love for one another that is genuine, the harmony and diversity that the gospel produces, like nothing else you'll see in the world. And then finally, chapter 16. The gospel really is doing this. This is not just theory. This is not just a high ideal that Paul set that's impossible to achieve. But remember this glimpse in chapter 16. Here it is actually happening in practice in Rome. This diverse group of people working together for the gospel, living as living sacrifices for this message, behind this mission. It really is happening. And I guess we could extend that to examples we see around us even here. And I've realised as we've gone through over the year that we need to revisit what Paul is doing. I've put those three stages there at the bottom, declaring the gospel, producing conviction, producing lives in obedience to Jesus. So I've realised as we've gone through that Paul is not just wanting to make the Roman church sorted as if it's a one-way process only, so that they're living nice lives in obedience to Jesus and everything's kind of ironed out. But actually, it's a big cycle. It's a virtuous cycle, not a one-way process. So if you get a pen, I need you to make a major addition to that flow diagram. Because as we see lives lived in obedience to Jesus, we see the power of this message in action. And so we need an arrow going back to the conviction in the gospel that produces. But as we're deepening conviction in the gospel, that also makes us want to declare it more, doesn't it? So we need another arrow going back to the beginning. It's a cycle that will keep on going, keep on growing, keep on strengthening us and expanding this mission. As we've been studying Romans this year, as we've been given more confidence in it, as we've been given more understanding of it, hasn't it made us want to know it more ourselves and for others to know it too? As we've seen it take root in our lives and impact us, haven't we wanted to have that impact on more people and on ourselves more and more? So you can have some arrows going back the other way. Okay, let's now turn for the last few minutes and for over the summer, as I said, to keep talking about these things. Again, maybe just pick one of those questions at the bottom there for now and then turn to pray in response to what we've been talking about. And do take this, keep thinking about it yourself, keep meeting up and talking more about Romans. But yeah, so do that and then turn to pray.